Yeah, that's the a little bit of the history of the United States. The number of people who were involved in the revolution who were all wanted men and women, for that matter. That we were a freer society before the American Revolution. That is to say, more individual freedoms before the American Revolution. Kind of a mind bender, I think, for a lot of folks. It's just part of the experience of reading a renegade history of the United States. We'll get into the Civil War coming up, and then also World War II. And especially when we talk about the Civil War, this is going to offend, I think, some people's sensibilities. Especially when it came to the history of slavery. But Thaddeus Russell says he's got the documentation to back it up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. I confess, Dr. Thaddeus Russell, to being oddly uncomfortable reading the whole chapter about slavery.
I've heard that before.
Yeah. And I don't know that I had any kind of operating myth about what life was like for slaves in America. I have this profound sadness that we ever did it. And I can, even through all these centuries, I feel the misery of slavery and what it was like. But you make some interesting points that I think are also equally shocking for many people from whatever side of history politically they stand on. And that's that in many ways, slaves, this is going to sound weird, everybody hang on, that slaves had more freedom than the average white American.
So I began this by examining this very curious phenomenon in American history, which is more than 200 years old now, of whites imitating, emulating, and apparently envying African Americans. And this goes all the way back to the early 19th century. Throughout the 19th century, by far, and all historians agree on this who have studied it, by far throughout the 19th century, the most popular form of entertainment was the blackface minstrel show. And historians before me, several of them, have already argued that the early blackface minstrel shows, the ones in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, 1830s, 40s, and 50s, this is still when slavery was in effect, of course, actually exhibited a tremendous degree of envy and actually a real wish to be at least like or more like slaves. And I just, it's very shocking to me when I first heard this argument when I was in graduate school. But it's been a curious phenomenon that, of course, continued long after that. And we still, to this day, the largest consumers of hip hop are whites. From the jazz age onward, this has been a recurring theme in American culture, a very powerful one. And so I began to begin to try to figure out why that could be. Was it just fantasy? Was it just projecting these images onto slaves, these desires that did not exist, these pleasures and freedoms that did not exist among them, and it's just not true. 19th century, of course, was the era of Victorianism. This was a time of intense repression. Many historians have talked about this at great length, in which, textbooks that were given to children from kindergarten on preached the work ethic, that they should learn to work and be useful and to discipline themselves from, beginning of life, basically, and to give up playthings, childish things, fun, and leisure. Across the board, it was pounded into Americans that work in itself, regardless of what you gained from it materially, was a good thing, was godly. There was a huge wave of sexual repression in America. There were endless sexual manuals, marital advice manuals, telling Americans to shun all forms of non-marital sex and to even severely limit what they did in the bedroom with their spouses. One of the fastest growing industries in the 19th century was for devices that stopped people from masturbating. There was
Right.
a very popular product was a hobble, what was called a hobble that kept women from opening their legs. And again, historians have talked about this before. So what I tried to do is connect all of these different streams in American history, and I came to a very stunning conclusion, but one that it seems absolutely clear to me now, having done the research and putting it together, which is that there was a lot in slave culture to envy, actually, for white people living in Victorian era America, which many people said, by the way, was even more repressive than in Britain, than in where Victorianism originated. Slaves did not have these ideas about work and sex. The idea, the Protestant work ethic was not invented in West Africa. The idea that all forms of non-marital sex were sinful was not invented in West Africa. And when they were brought here, they had no reason to adopt these cultural norms, right? They were excluded in all ways from that culture, which I argue is this ironic benefit to slavery. Not to say that slaves lived completely wonderful lives. There were indeed whippings. There, you know, obviously they could not control always where they lived.
Right.
There were indeed many families who were broken apart by sales of slaves. No question about that. But they practiced a life, a day-to-day life, that was much looser, more flexible, and I would say just simply freer in terms of those ideas about how to live sexually and in terms of work and all these things. And so there was much to be envied by the typical white American who, for the most part, was a farmer, most likely was a farmer. Farmers worked and still work, but certainly then, you know, worked from before the sun came up till well after the sun went down. Slaves didn't work that hard. Economic historians have found that on average, northern farmers during slavery worked on average 400 hours more per year than did slaves. For one thing, masters found that they simply could only get so much work out of slaves by whipping them. And so the number of whippings was actually far less than we are led to believe. Most historians agree that it was roughly one per slave per year, which to us is still an unspeakable horror. I mean,
it is. It is. And we can't not playing that down, but that's that I want to amplify what you just said there too, is that there's just so much work you can get out of somebody that you are physically driving into the ground. It becomes counterproductive for a slave owner to continually physically hobble the person that you're expecting to produce.
Right. And so you have manuals written by slave masters for other slave masters telling them to use the lash as little as possible because they said that they got diminishing returns from it. But for the northern farmer, he had two things that compelled him to work like a mule. One was having to grow a life out of this ground, cut down the trees, perhaps kill the Indians to get there, and then grow food and out of the ground to make a life out of that was just alone required what one famous American called a life of infinite labor. That was one thing that compelled them, just the material circumstances of their lives. The second thing was the Protestant work ethic, which was absolutely central in American culture and hammered home to Americans, which said that if you do not work every minute you can, you are giving the minutes of your leisure to Satan. This was the message given from kindergarten all the way through adulthood. Very central in American culture, certainly in the 19th century. It still is now in many ways. And so there was reason to look at the way blacks thought about these things with envy. If you had any desire for personal freedom, not all Americans participated in blackface minstrel shows, but millions and millions and millions did. In fact, it's arguable that virtually every white American in the 19th century at some point witnessed a blackface performance. It was that popular. These were white men for the most part who painted their faces black and acted as they thought at least slaves behaved. And, you know, it was reductionist. It did reduce slave life to particular aspects. And of course, there's never an accurate, perfectly accurate portrayal of a culture. But the point is that my argument is that they had reason to envy people who didn't believe in the Protestant work ethic, who didn't believe that sex was wicked.
Yeah, I found that fascinating. I mean, that white America, mainstream white America, secretly wished it weren't going through the experience that it had. Feels really good about it, feels very superior about it,
right,
but at the same time isn't enjoying it. And that's why these minstrel shows are so popular, because they are too mythologizing the life of a slave, but they're looking at a slave's life going, I wish that were me. I mean, that's just, it's an odd conflict in history, but I'll let other people read the chapter and resolve that to themselves. We're talking about a renegade history of the United States, but it does bring us to the Civil War. who was for it? Who is against it? What have you found that's different than mainstream thought on the Civil War?
Well, I mean, one of the things that people have really missed, with very few exceptions, even among professional historians, is that the opponents of slavery, the leading opponents of slavery, were very much opponents of personal freedom. The abolitionists, who were the first to call for the abolition of slavery, the ending of slavery, were deeply puritanical. They were, by and large, Calvinists. We've known this for a long time about them. I mean, they led extremely repressive lives. And what's been missed, only one historian has really written about this, a man named Ronald Walters, a great historian who's now retired. But in the 1970s, he wrote a couple of books showing that abolitionists, one of the things they hated about slavery the most, perhaps the thing they hated most about it, was that it created a life of freedom, ironically, among the slaves. Abolitionists, the problem they had with slavery, one of the problems they had with it, was that the slaves were having too much fun. And so they wrote book after book and pamphlet after pamphlet about the terrible work ethic of the slaves, their terrible debauched morals about concerning sexuality, the fact that they had no problem with women having sex outside of marriage. They wanted to correct that. They wanted to bring the dominant white culture of the North into the plantation. That was why they wanted to go to war. They wanted to make the South look like the North in that way, Northern white culture, Puritan into Victorian culture.
And you say that people miss this. What is your what is the documentation for this, that the abolitionists weren't just basing this, as I remember reading about Abraham Lincoln, who talked about he believed that slavery would be a stain on the soul of the United States and we would not be blessed by God until we got rid of it. He didn't seem puritanical. Abraham Lincoln didn't seem like he was coming from that point of view. He just thought it was morally wrong.
Morally wrong, the argument, morally wrong because it was a system of external control. It's the same argument the Founding Fathers made against the British. The Founding Fathers said, the reason we have a libertine culture in the streets, the reason we have so much prostitution and drinking in the streets, is that it's a system of external control. People have not taught themselves to feel shame about those behaviors. The exact same argument was made by abolitionists. The slaves, the problem with slavery was that it was a system of external controls. It was only driven by the lash. The slaves had no feelings of guilt and shame, the great controlling mechanisms in the person. They had no reason to discipline themselves. And so William Lloyd Garrison, the greatest abolitionist of all time, even Frederick Douglass talked about this. Many abolitionists said this time and again. A system of external control will create people who live like savages. They were not racist in the sense that they believed that slaves were biologically inclined to behave in those ways. Lincoln was, but the abolitionists, the radical abolitionists, were not. What was sort of the dark irony of their position was that they believed that slaves could indeed become good Puritans, just like they were. They could be made this way. And so during Reconstruction, immediately after the war, well, actually began during the war, the Freedmen's Bureau was charged with teaching the slaves how to be citizens. And so they set up hundreds of schools, Freedmen's Bureau schools across the South. Most slaves went through those schools. Most slaves went into those schools probably expecting to be taught reading, writing, and arithmetic, and they were taught those things, but they were also given these very stern moral lessons. And we have the textbooks that were taught to them. We know exactly what was taught to them. And these textbooks were written by deeply committed Victorians, people who preached again and again, what you should do is when you wake up in the morning, you should go to work, and you should work as long as you can, and when you go home, do not stop at the saloon. Do not spend do not spend a minute on your own personal freedom. Come home and then spend every waking minute, possible minute, with your family, being a family person. Now, I'm not saying that's necessarily a bad way to live, but what I am saying is that there are other ways to live that many people have chosen, and that any idea of personal freedom was lost in that vision.
Yeah, I think you're pretty much describing my life.
Mine too at times, unfortunately.
Yeah, I don't drink. I never have. But at the same time, I always feel like it's everybody's right to do that. But there are so many of these, again, so many of these impulses that go back so much further in our American history that I think people understand. And so when you look at this movement, this abolitionist movement, Would you think of that as a progressive movement out of the capital P progressivism, or would you think of that as a conservative movement in kind of the Calvinistic way of, you know, of sort of self-denial and trying to capture some unreal but imagined past?
I think it was a transition between the two. I think the abolitionist movement is really unrecognized as being that. So they were very much interested in moral suasion, and they were very much interested in implanting what they, and they said this, implanting shame, shame is what the word they used, into the minds of the slaves, to make them operate correctly, properly, on their own. However, they also, during Reconstruction, the Freedmen's Bureau forced, in many cases, slaves to work. So slaves, a lot of slaves left the plantation and said, finally, you know,
right,
now is my time. And many slaves just walked away and wandered the roads. They were rounded up by the Freedmen's Bureau, actually encouraged, begged in many cases, local authorities, the police essentially, to round up black men and women who were found not working and take them back to the plantations, which were now operated as wage labor plantations.
Yeah, very low wage labor.
Right, they were forced to work, but they were given lesson after lesson after lesson and told. In fact, there are many cases of union officers marching onto the plantation and kicking off the master and then giving a speech. They were told to give a speech to the slaves that they encountered. They're suddenly surrounded by all these slaves, and what do you say? Well, they were told to tell them, and we have the speeches. It's in the records. It's not hard to find. They would give these long speeches to the slaves telling them, okay, now, to be a good citizen, to be a good American, you must work willfully. Now the lash will not control you. Your own conscience will make you work. That is it. You are now responsible for your own life. And so that, in a sense, is a wonderful idea, but it's also, there was this very heavy, heavy moralism that was attached to it that was very dark, very stern, and in some cases, I would say psychologically violent, because there was this, an attack on the way people live, the way people thought, their identities, their cultural norms, their values. And so that's you know, again, it's the dark side of democracy playing out in the Civil War. That was very much a motivation for going to war for many people, in particular, ironically, the most radical, so-called radical of the abolitionists, the ones who were most adamant about ending the institution.
Is ending one institution and creating another that's just as repressive, but done done properly. So, am I wrong in making a connection between some of the things you just mentioned there, and Margaret Sanger and the birth of birth control and that movement?
Not at all. I mean, there's an interest. I mean, I have a lot on birth control and history of it in the book.
Yeah, because at one time you could walk into any store and get you walk into a coffee shop and get birth control. I mean, that they had like sheepskin condoms everywhere before the American Revolution. You could just go. That's just so funny to me.
And lots of comments, observers, writers, you know, from Europe and elsewhere would come and visit these American cities, and they would report back that they were in just some sort of corner store, like a local store selling in it, and they would find all these forms of birth control. Also, by the way, they would find a lot of pornography. This was during the year of the revolution.
Yeah. So then we'll hang on to that thought. Then we'll explore that. The connection between the dark side of so-called progressivism and birth control, Margaret Sanger on that. And then I think when you talk about the beginning of Planned Parenthood, it's a very natural transition into a discussion about fascism and the New Deal. A renegade history of the United States. In the end, no matter where you come from politically, there will be plenty of in here in this book that will make you uncomfortable. Some things you'll be championing, going, yes, I've always believed that. And other things you're like, no, that can't possibly be true. But they're both equally fascinating. We'll get to more with Thaddeus Russell before we get to your questions and comments coming up. And remember that this is the night we fall back. So we're adding an extra hour at the end of the show. We're going back to an interview we had with Al Jardine of the Beach Boys, which was way cool, as he talked about the secret history of the Beach Boys, as it were, on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. That's right. Waking up from history. That's a theme for A Renegade History of the United States. Dr. Thaddeus Russell, a professor of history at Occidental. Got into the intellectual scrape at Columbia University, well, Barnard College, as a result of this early material, this now book, and he's probably ruffling a few feathers tonight too. We'll get back to Margaret Sanger, the birth of the birth control movement, and the dark side of democracy as it continues to be played out during World War II. Next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. It's a renegade history of the United States. So we dropped off there talking about the dark side of democracy in terms of whether movements are really progressive or are they conservative, which, and this keeps coming up again as a theme. It depends on how you look at it, and also ultimately what the goal was of the people that are behind it, remembered differently perhaps in the history books until now. So what about Margaret Sanger? What about you know, the idea of birth control and how that was supposed to be empowering?
Well, I mean, there's the backstory that I give to this in the book is one of my favorites, which is that in 1873, the Comstock Act was passed by Congress, which essentially made it illegal to distribute birth control. Or it did, in fact, make it illegal to distribute birth control. And so what happened was that a large number of mostly Jewish immigrants in New York City began to produce it on their own, illegally, underground, often in the basements of their tenements or in their row houses in New York City. They did this for the length of the Comstock Act, which was in effect until the 1920s. They produced virtually all the birth control, the condoms and the diaphragms that were used by Americans during that long period. And of course, their number one customers were prostitutes during that time. And so these were unassimilated immigrants, right? People we condemn, you know, for their unwillingness or inability to assimilate into American culture. They did this without any shame. They saw, you know, this market that they could exploit. Illegally, and that they kept alive, I argue, sexual freedom for all Americans during this period. It was possible to have sex without unwanted consequences because of these unassimilated immigrants and prostitutes for many years.
Well, then again, also, who was keeping the prostitution trade running? It wasn't, you know, there was lots of good, upstanding, you know, politicians and pillars of communities that were visiting prostitutes who then weren't getting pregnant because they were getting illegal birth control from this group of immigrants.
Sure. I mean, clients of prostitutes run across the classes and always have. And certainly during this period, it was still an immensely profitable enterprise, even in this period. And this was decades before Margaret Sanger opened her first birth control clinics in Brooklyn. And so, I mean, I, of course, you know, I'm obviously a great supporter of birth control. I think it's a wonderful thing, one of the greatest things ever to happen in American culture or in world culture, really. And I'm glad that Margaret Sanger did what she did, and she certainly contributed to sexual freedom. But there's no question, Planned Parenthood denies this, and I'm a supporter of what Planned Parenthood does. Unfortunately, they deny the real history, which is that Margaret Sanger was deeply committed to what was called eugenics.
Yes.
The idea that poor people were poor because there was something genetically wrong with them, that they were born that way. There was a biological imperfection, flaw inside of them that made them do these things that made them poor. And so, in fact, this is one of the reasons that one of her largest projects later in her career was to bring birth control to Harlem. And she worked with many black leaders, in fact, in Harlem to bring birth control to Harlem. And unfortunately, there was a deep racist implication to this. She believed that blacks had a biological defect that made them promiscuous, that ended up making them, you know, belong at the bottom of society. And so she wanted to correct that. She was very interested in giving birth control primarily to the lower classes because she believed that, unfortunately, they were genetically predisposed to that status.
And this put her in a group, the eugenics believers, with a lot of people who are supporters of Hitler.
Yeah, so there's an incredible sort of nexus of groups here in the early and mid 20th century. This is basically the high period of eugenics in American culture was from the 20s through the New Deal, through the 1930s, and even into the 1940s a bit. Tens of thousands of people were forcibly sterilized for eugenic reasons. Most of them women, or many women were, because promiscuous women, illicit women, so-called fallen women, were forcibly sterilized because of this. It's people who were called idiots, now we would call them other things, but were sterilized because of this, so they would not breed and create more idiots and morons. Many criminals were sterilized for this reason. The leaders of the eugenics movement were all part of the progressive movement. These were people like Margaret Sanger, and these were people who ended up being the intellectual founders of the New Deal. There's no question about that. Sterilization, eugenic sterilization, spiked dramatically in the 1930s during the New Deal era. Franklin Roosevelt and the New Dealers in Washington, D.C., sort of like the Founding Fathers, did not call for this specifically, but they certainly created a culture in which it thrived. And so there is, and eugenics, you know, one of the place they learned a lot of this ideas about eugenics from German social scientists in the 1920s, who also were the intellectual founders of fascism in Europe.
Yeah.
There's a lot of sharing of ideas, and in fact, Germans were in some ways more influenced by American eugenicists than vice versa.
Well, it is something which you just, if you want to pick a fight with somebody from Planned Parenthood, that's all you have to do is talk about its authenticated, real history. And this whitewashed PR version of Margaret Sanger as some sort of saint is just, it's not, it's beyond laughable. It's sort of an insidious thing. Why can't people just admit this is, even if they agree with how the movement ended up, lots of movements started for the wrong reasons and end up being the right thing. Why can't this be one of those things instead of having to pretend like it was something other than it was?
Yeah, it's really tragic. I mean, I would love to just be a wholehearted supporter of Planned Parenthood. And again, I am absolutely in what they do, what they accomplish. It's a wonderful thing. Thank God for it. And I wish they would be less afraid of right-wing hysteria, you know, and simply admit, say, yes, there were these motivations behind it that were sort of unseemly, but what we got out of it was a wonderful thing.
Okay, but let's identify, what would we call Margaret Sanger? If she's, you know, in the same club meetings as Henry Ford or other supporters of eugenics, do we think of her as left-wing or right-wing?
Boy, I mean, that's, in a sense, that is one of the major critiques that's running through the book, which is a critique of what we call liberalism now, modern liberalism,
yeah,
which was born by progressives, the progressive movement in the early 20th century. And, you know, there's just immense amount of evidence. There's just no question that most of the progressives were interested primarily in social control. They really were inspired or in their actions by this huge wave of immigration. This is following the second, so-called second great wave of immigration from the early 19th century through the early 20th, which brought all of these people from peasant societies who had, again, sort of like the slaves, very different ideas about sex, about work, about personal freedom. They had to be brought into and trained to be members of this industrializing society. This is also at the time of the Industrial Revolution. This is when people who worked in factories worked 12, 13, 14, 15, 16 hours a day, and they worked 6 days a week, sometimes 7 days a week. That took an incredible breaking of one's soul, you know, to get
right
them to do that. And there's a huge amount of evidence that a lot of immigrants during this period from Southern and Eastern Europe came into these factories and just refused to do it, just refused to work that hard. Herbert Gutman, a great historian, was the first to document this. It's well known that there was quite a lot of rejection of industrial discipline. And also, you know, the growth of the city, the urban machine in the cities, you know, run by immigrants who control the politics in the cities. Progressives were primarily interested in attacking those. It's one of the things they accomplished, in fact, was the elimination through various measures of the urban immigrant machines. They saw a world of chaos, and they were horrified by it. And these were all, you know, these were white Protestants. These were
right
people who really were descendants, I argue, of the Founding Fathers, of the abolitionists, who were interested in social order. And so birth control,
as social order as they saw it, as they perceived it,
yes,
to be.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Right.
And this is, you know, there's sort of a divide among people in general, I think, you know, between those who are more interested in social order and those people who are more interested in their own interests, their own desires, their own pleasures. That is how I look at American history, through that lens. by seeing that tension in American history. That's what's new about the book.
Well, and I think you challenge all of our easy notions about who is wearing what colored hat through history, and we'll just leave that there because I want to have time here to talk about the New Deal, World War II, and who was really for it and who was really against it. How popular was World War II?
It certainly was to some extent. You know, I mean, Tom Brokaw is not entirely wrong in his book, The Greatest Generation, which paints this picture of 100% unanimity behind the war. There was a whole lot of sort of tacit, I would say, dissent, not explicit dissent. There were some people who opposed the war on moral or political reasons. They were put in prison, but then we're talking about tens of thousands, a significant number. I don't want to diminish it, but there was a whole much greater numbers of people who resisted the war effort just through tacit efforts or tacit lack of effort, in a sense. So for one thing, people don't realize this, but roughly two-thirds of the men who fought in World War II for the United States were drafted. This is 10 million people were forcibly conscripted, forced to fight in the war. That alone tells you that there was a limited amount of commitment to the war effort. Black men went through tremendous efforts, all kinds of very creative efforts to avoid fighting in the war. Their levels of resistance to conscription were much higher than among whites, for many good reasons. Mexican Americans, same thing. Those are just two examples of, you know, how there was much less unanimity behind the war effort than we're led to believe. Another tremendous fact is that 6 million Americans on the home front went on strike in the defense industries, inside the defense industries in Detroit and other places, where they were building tanks and planes and guns for the war effort. They wanted 6 million of them participated in what were called wildcat strikes in the defense industries during the war. They were denounced as being traitorous and selfish and unpatriotic. And they did it for all sorts of reasons, many of which we might even consider trivial, things like not having cigarette breaks, having foremen they didn't like. There was this very tight labor market, right? And so they had this power to do this, to walk out and not be replaced so easily, sort of like the drunks in the 18th century, right? It was very difficult for employers to replace them because much of the workforce was in Europe or in the Pacific fighting. So, you know, that's right there. We're talking now about many millions of people who were either forcibly conscripted to fight or who resisted the war effort at the home, on the home front and the domestic front.
And politically, how does the New Deal, how close was the New Deal under Roosevelt to fascism?
Well, you would have to, if you could, I mean, the best people to ask would be Adolf Hitler and Benito Mussolini, who were wildly enthusiastic about the New Deal all the way through the mid to even late 1930s, basically until Roosevelt made it clear that he was going to war against them. When Roosevelt took office and began to institute the early New Deal policies, Adolf Hitler wrote him letters praising him, saying that the German people were fully behind him. Many Nazi writers, intellectuals, wrote books, wrote reviews of Roosevelt's books, wrote in the major Nazi newspaper saying that, boy, this looks a lot like what we're doing here, and we really hope you're successful with the New Deal. The early New Deal, the major plank of what's called the Early New Deal was the National Recovery Act, which was classic, what we now call corporatism, which was a form of economic governance that was established by the fascists in Italy in the 1920s, which was this sharing of power between government and business and labor, but with government always having the upper hand, and in fact, most importantly, having the executive having the upper hand in all major economic decisions. So there were cartels established by the NRA for all major American industries in the early New Deal, cartels in which the leaders of the 5 or 10 or 15 leading businesses in each industry literally sat at a table in Washington, D.C. with a member of the Roosevelt cabinet, and they established prices, they established wages, they established production quotas. This was precisely the economic model that was taken up in Italy and Germany in the 1930s.
But it didn't mean the Roosevelt administration was pro-Hitler.
Well, no. I mean, not the administration itself. However, many, many progressives who were the leading intellectual supporters of the New Deal were wildly enthusiastic about fascism. So you have the New Republic wrote editorial after editorial praising Mussolini's grand experiment in modernity, for instance.
Right.
And Rexford Tugwell, who was a leader of the Roosevelt cabinet, who was instrumental in establishing the NRA, was explicitly sympathetic to the fascist model of government. He was hostile to democracy. He was hostile to free markets. Donald Rickberg was another one who really wrote the NRA. He was very enthusiastic about the fascist economic and political model.
And an NRA, again, for people, is the National Recovery Act. So then where was classic Republicanism? Where was the GOP during this time? Where was their head and heart?
Well, I mean, they were the opposition to Roosevelt and the New Deal. And some of them, not all of them, opposed it on the grounds that it did look a lot like what was going on in Germany. Some of the GOP made this critique early on. In fact, this is where this analysis of the New Deal originated, was in some members of the Republican Party who were the first to say this in the 1940s. It's actually, by now, even some liberal historians are saying it as well. This has been documented pretty extensively for the last 20 or 30 years. So, you know, that's where it was. That was the opposition. But there were many people in the United States, even liberals at the time, were saying, boy, we are headed down a road that looks a lot like Italy and Germany.
Yet Roosevelt wanted to support England, wanted us to go to war to support England against Germany. Who was the opposition then to him doing that?
Well, there were various isolationists, most of them in the Republican Party, some on the left, who opposed that. My argument is that the World War II was, in a sense, a battle between siblings for control of the world, that Roosevelt certainly wanted, and he did everything he could, obviously, to annihilate fascism, the fascist regimes, not fascism, but the fascist regimes who were his rivals, his competitors in Europe. Roosevelt was, from the beginning of his career, an imperialist, and he made no bones about this. I mean, he was very eager to get involved in the war against Japan. He, in many ways, forced, essentially, Japan to attack Pearl Harbor. Historians have said this as well. He was very eager to get into the war in Europe, and his problem was that the American people weren't so eager to do that. And so it took the attack on Pearl Harbor to finally get the American people on his side. So really, the real opposition, and again, this backs up my claim that World War II wasn't quite as popular as we're led to believe, the real opposition, the most troubling opposition to Roosevelt, and he said this, was from the American people themselves.
But in this case, it's because you mentioned isolationism, that we were still stinging from World War I. We're just coming out of the Depression, and nobody wanted to rock the boat by getting into a war. Is that roughly the perception?
Well, I mean, we don't know for sure what people were thinking, but, you know, the poll said again and again, all the way up until December of 1941, that, you know, vast majority of Americans have no interest in going to war. They did not feel that Hitler was a threat. They did not feel that the Japanese Empire was a threat. They just simply did not see it as their interest until Japan attacked, you know, our shores. So
so Roosevelt was pro-fascism in the model, as long as fascism was being done within a democratic structure. He was anti-fascist in the way that Hitler or Mussolini were actually the figureheads for that sort of totalitarianism. So he liked some aspects of it, wanted to use it, felt like he and other elites were the people that knew best. And the American people, at the same time, didn't feel threatened by Hitler. It's all very confusing, but it's so interesting, the renegade history of the United States. And we'll get to your questions, your comments coming up. Thaddeus Russell, a professor at Occidental College in California. I still have a couple of questions that will come up along the way, some pages I dog-eared, but no doubt you've been dog-earing some things in your mind all along you want to get back to, too, and perhaps even some aspects of history we haven't addressed yet. This is the guy. If you've ever thought that you had a renegade view of American history, this is your man. Find out whether or not he agrees with you coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Bonnett.